live from the mist-enshrouded mountaintop fortress that is X and Y Communications headquarters. You're listening to the world-famous Mountaintop Podcast. And now, here's your host, Scott McKay.
Welcome, welcome to a very special episode number 100 of the big show, the Mountaintop Podcast. Now, for this milestone show, I wanted to do something particularly special for you. And I think I've succeeded at doing exactly that. I've managed to get, as a co-host, a man who has been by far the greatest influence on not only how I think about women and relationships, but also how I actually live in relationship with women, interacting with them, and of course, having a blissful relationship with my lovely wife, Emily. That man is, of course, none other than my dad, Russell McKay Jr. Dad, welcome to the show, man.
Well, thanks, Scott. I'm very proud to be here. Even put on a tie.
Wow, really?
I'm retired.
You're all dressed up, and here we are, audio only.
This is great. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're here. We've been talking about this literally for months, having you on for episode number 100. And of course, the reason why I'm so psyched is I've been doing this for 11 years, and I've never introduced these guys to you before. And I think this is the perfect time.
Yeah, I think so, too. I put it on last year's calendar. And I'm glad we finally got around to it.
Yeah, we're a little slow in this family sometimes. So let's go ahead and dive right in. Now, the first question I'm going to ask you, I need to preface a little bit by saying that you and Mom have been married for 55 years, and you were both married as teenagers, which, of course, is now almost unheard of in today's modern world to get married that young. Everybody goes to high school, then they go to college, then they go to graduate school, then they do whatever for 10 years, and finally somewhere around 35 they marry, you know, and then start having kids. That seems like that's what people do nowadays. Yet your relationship with Mom, of course, has survived all these years and has been incredibly healthy. The first question, of course, I have to ask you is, how did you know Mom was the right one, Dad?
Well, I was only 17 and she was 16. So we were still growing and, you know, becoming ourselves. But I think you only believe in love at first sight if it happens to you. I guess it starts out as a mad infatuation, but it grows and grows. And, you know, you start to, you know, really decide as you go along, building your relationship. I mean, you can't fake love. Your look, your voice, speech, I guess your body language and your touch, they all convey love back and forth over a span of time. And that's where deep love involves both of you, I think. I think love is probably as close as being finite beings, it's probably as close as we can get to infinity, because wow. I don't think there's any end to love. I mean, as you know, I've had three children, love them all, love my wife. The love is endless. If I had 20 children, I would have loved them all. So I think love is the one touch with infinity that we can have as human beings.
You know, I'm really glad you didn't have 20 children, Dad.
Me too.
There would have been reality TV and, you know, smaller Christmas presents and all that terrible stuff.
Oh, college, I was thinking of.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyway. See, now, shame on me as a dad for not even thinking of that yet. Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's really powerful what you just said. You know, in a world where people are sort of impulsive when they go through that infatuation, eloping to Vegas or whatever, you and Mom did wait a while to feel into that love a little bit and realize that you were the right ones for each other. But I think it's incredibly interesting that you would say that you knew pretty much right away that Mom was the woman for you, even at that age.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it was so strange when the way we met, because I was at the gas station pumping gas as, it's a part-time job. And this guy kept coming in with this gorgeous Pontiac Bonneville, pink and purple, if you can imagine. And that was the colors that the factory painted, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway.
That was Uncle Bob.
Uncle Bob. And I love that car. And we used to talk cars because I had a 56 Oldsmobile 98 at that time, too. So anyway, he said, are you busy, Sunday? I said, why? What do you want to do? I figured something car related. He said, I'd like you to meet my sister. And I just kind of looked at him and he said, she's good looking. And I said, I'm dating a pretty good looking girl right now.
That's my dad.
He said, no, go ahead. You know, you come on down. You won't be, you know, it'll be fine. So I said, okay. So actually, I went there and I was in the living room and waiting. And I met your grandmother and Aunt Bonnie. And then your mom came down the steps.
Now, Aunt Bonnie, of course, is 11 years older than me. And
she was four.
Yeah, and she was four at the time that you met Mom. Now, here,
that's right.
I've just now put two and two together that you had to meet the girl's mom before you even ever met the girl.
Well, she was downstairs and your mom was upstairs.
Right. Well, no pressure because you don't even know who this girl's going to be yet.
Well, perfect. I was a little bit nervous, anticipatory nervous, not, you know, shaky nervous, but it wasn't unpleasant. It just didn't want to be that way. But anyway, she came down and that was it.
That was it.
It was 3:34 p.m. on September 25th, 1959.
Wow.
That was the first minute the rest of my life, actually.
1959. Yep. September 25th.
And in less time than it took me to tell you all this, I was hooked. That was it. And I just built on from there. And I couldn't believe, I mean, you always try to date over your station in life. And
right.
I certainly did that.
You dated up there.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. And, we just got along great. It was like it wasn't that we needed each other, is that we just blended together so well.
You do what I tell these guys, Emily and I do, which is get each other.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course. It became the we, actually. What are we going to do? You know?
Exactly.
Well, what do you want to do? Well, what do you want to do? Well, what do we want to do? Okay, then we'll do that. You know, that kind of thing. And it moved along like that. Now, I did have some attributes. I was singer in a rock and roll band, and I had just joined the Navy Reserve. So at 17, I was,
You were kind of a badass.
Well, I don't know about that, but I had a few feathers in my cap on. But in any case, I was there hat in hand, though.
Now, Grandma and Grandpa are from the Deep South, and they had just moved mm-hmm. to Baltimore, which is by far the northernmost place they'd ever lived. And Mom...
Absolutely.
Yeah, and Mom has this Southern accent that is like stereotypically Southern Belle-like. That knocked you out, didn't it?
Well, I mean, I was just trying to decide where to look because she had a sweater on and she had Bermuda shorts on, and I couldn't... I wanted to look at all of her and keep looking, but I had to keep my eyes moving. And I was starting to get control when she said hi. And it was like one short syllable, though it sounded like one and a half because she put that sugar on it, you know, and I had never heard anything like that before.
Right.
So I said hi back or something, but I really don't remember.
You had me from hi, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then we went outside, I guess, to be together, you know. And I don't know how, but she even looked better in the sunlight.
I was going to say, she even looked better in bright light. Imagine.
Exactly. And so, I don't know. It was, I couldn't remember much, but I can remember I couldn't stop smiling.
Wow.
I remember that.
Which is usually bad for your health when you're trying to attract women.
Well,
I know. Cheesy like
hey,
that.
Hey, I wasn't trying to attract. I was just trying to stand upright.
You're just trying to hold it together.
Exactly.
That's exactly how I felt when Emily walked through the door the morning we met.
It's a great feeling.
I know the day and the time, too.
Everybody deserves it.
Oh, yeah.
To give it and to get it back, you know?
So, Dad, what are the secrets to the great relationship over the years? It's just been amazing. I don't think I've ever seen you and Mom get into a legitimate hate fest before.
Oh, no. We never had a fight.
Never. No.
Our disagreements, we, you know, worked out.
Is that reasonable for guys to expect, though? Because I think a lot of guys are probably listening to this show going, oh, there's just no way. 55 years? I don't even believe it. But, you know, I can assure this whole audience, it's true. None of us, my sister Heather, David, my brother, none of us have ever seen you two really get into a fight before. And it's just been an incredible example over the years. Is that just a matter of you two being on the same wavelength so perfectly? Or is there something else there?
I don't really know what it is other than the chemistry of it all, but all I can say is that probably can't expect that, but you can work at it. I mean, you can not get involved in areas where you do know that you have inherent disagreements, but the thing is to try to stick to things that you can agree on. I mean, that's what moves you forward, you know, and major things are important, like career or children. So a lot of that, you just depend on love, really, is what you do. I mean, it's trust and love, and you can't fake it. It's got to be real. And I think if you're sincere with each other all the time, that's what really makes a great, you know, two should be three. I mean, you know, it should be more than the two.
Like more than the sum of its parts, like 1 + 1 = 4 or 5.
Absolutely. Because if you're thinking as one, you can get so much more accomplished. And you're both going in the same direction. You're not pulling apart.
One of the areas that I think you've really influenced not only how I think, but how I teach as a dating coach is this whole idea of being a leader in the relationship, definitely wearing the pants in the family, but somehow also leading in the family's best interest. And I think mom has always modeled a wonderful example of still being an adult and being your co-equal in that marriage, but she absolutely trusts your leadership and your decision-making because she knows you're acting in her best interest.
Well, you build up trust. I mean, if you make good decisions and continue to make good decisions that kind of work out, then, you know, you gain more trust. So, I mean, that's just natural part of it, I think. I mean, it's biblical that the man shall lead, but I mean, nowadays, there's so much activity. And plus, you are two individual people. So you have to appreciate and applaud the individuality at the same time being a couple. Your mom doesn't like sports like I like sports. And of course, I don't like to watch, you know, chick flicks like she does and all of that. But I mean, we can get together on some other things and watch things together. And I think time apart, a small amount of time apart is good as well. Although, you know, you don't want to be lonely and feel separated. But even when you're apart, you kind of feel that the other person has your best interest at all times.
Now, you mentioned this whole idea of trust, and you also have mentioned just now that idea of spending time apart. But you've spent considerable amounts of time apart from mom, even early on as you shipped out in the Navy and went on like a 6 or 8 month cruise. And then later, when you were in the business world and had climbed the corporate ladder, which we'll get to later, you would go from Baltimore, where we lived and grew up, to New York and sometimes stay there all week. And still, the relationship stayed solid all along. So there really is something to what you're saying. I mean, did absence make the heart grow fonder? How did that exactly work? Or was that something you really would have rather not have had happen? Maybe obviously so, right?
Well, to tell the truth, I tried to get out of that cruise, that 6 month cruise to Africa. But then I was going anyway because it was the Navy. So anyway, it was a trip to Africa. Actually, it was President Kennedy wanted to send us over there to make friends in Africa. And also there was a secret mission as well. But mainly it was to make friends with in African countries that some of which no longer exist, actually, but at the time had never even met American Navy, let alone probably even Americans. I mean, we went to places they didn't even have airports and stuff. I mean, so the point is that, I mean, we were in the Indian Ocean. I think it was like 8,000 miles away from home. And I called your mom, you know, that was before satellites and everything else. But we managed to get a single sideband ham operator in Baltimore, where she lived at the time. And we rigged up a phone call from the Indian Ocean, the middle of the Indian Ocean. And it was like, I love you, over, you know, I love you too, yes. Over, you know, it was that kind of thing. And, you know, I was still fairly young and all, of course. But all of that, plus I wrote pretty much every day. We have copies of all the actual letters, you know, stacked up. But I mean, that's all important too. But it was a difficult time to some extent because she was still going to the senior year of her high school. And, you know, I was that guy in the Navy, you know, over in the Indian Ocean. So it was challenging, but we never had a problem with it. I mean, we knew each other was the one. Plus, technically, we were actually engaged. Because I had given her a ring when I left, you know. But the same thing with going to New York and all. It was easy. Of course, it was easy to get back home from New York because they had, after a couple of years, they had the Metroliner, which got to New York from Baltimore in 2 hours and 15 minutes. And I also had the phone every day and all of that. So I could easily reach and fairly quickly gotten home. So it wasn't quite the same. Plus, we were running a household and everything else then. So there was plenty of activity, you know, going on for each of us. And we were building a career together. I mean, my career was her career as well. So same thing with a family, you know. So it worked out pretty well.
Couple things there. First of all, you mentioned going to Africa in the Navy, but you left out one huge detail. You were part of this touring rock and roll band presented by the U.S. Navy as a goodwill gesture to people in Africa. And some of your best stories I've ever heard came from those days. And I would say you've absolutely influenced me as a world traveler by those stories you told. And of course, you and mom have gone on to visit all of Europe and the Caribbean and some other places too. So you and mom are world travelers as well. And all of that's been a huge influence. But I want you to tell these guys a little bit about what it was like to be in an American rock and roll band in Africa in 1960 when nobody had ever even heard this music before over there.
Well, it was actually 61, and it was the first sanctioned Navy rock and roll band. In fact, we went over there with a flotilla of six ships. We were the flagship, it's called, and we had the admiral aboard. Now, this was Admiral Eugene B. Flucky, who had red hair. I mean, red hair.
You can Google him.
You can.
Yeah.
And he was a rear admiral at the time, and he was, I think, the youngest in the Navy at the time. Anyway, he felt that we were taking a bunch of musicians, which actually is a Navy rate, believe it or not. You can join the Navy and just play music the whole time. But we were all just regular. I was a radarman, for instance, when I trained for the Navy. What he did was he wanted to have, in addition to his chorus, and in addition to his 14-piece swing band, he wanted to have a rock and roll band, because in 1961, rock and roll was, you know, past its infancy, but it was still toddling around.
You had to catch up with the times a little bit, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So what he did was he paid out of his own pocket $250 for a drum set, and we auditioned for membership in the band, which we named the Nomads. And I went to the audition and got it, I guess partly because I'd already been in a rock and roll band and had some experience with it and so forth. We had three singers, and we had, I think, 4 to 5 guitarists and things of that nature, some of which were regular seamen, and others of which were the people from the music group that he brought with him. So the first stop after we went to the equator, which we went through at 0000, by the way, we became emerald shellbacks.
Okay, that's better than golden shellback then.
Yes, even better, right. And by the way, did you know that the Earth travels at 1,037 miles an hour at the equator?
Did not know that.
It hardly seemed like it was moving to me, but anyway.
Well, look at the value we've already added to these guys right there. You learn something every day.
So we got into Bathurst, Gambia. Now, Bathurst, Gambia is as remote today probably as it was then, but I mean then it was really remote. So we went into a center of town, which was just a big circle with a bunch of leading roads coming into it, which weren't paved, by the way. But anyway, so the band set up the 16-piece orchestra, whatever it was, and then we also had the choir singing and all. And we had a few heads popping around trees and things like that, staring at us like we were aliens, which we were, of course. And then we took the stage. We hit two notes, and they ran to the stage. And we thought we were going to get run over. I mean, we thought they were stampeding.
Little more popular than the swing band.
And so we stopped. And they kept going, go, 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 whatever, you know, using their hands to try to tell us, play more, play more. And so, of course, we kicked it off and we played about 8 or 9 songs. And we were supposed to have another gig right behind that. They had scheduled us. We even had a lieutenant that did nothing but schedule our appearances the whole trip. But anyway, they wouldn't let us leave. They blocked us from getting off the stage. And so we kept putting up one finger like, one more, one more. And so we did have an interpreter there, though, and he quieted them down. But in any case, we were a big hit. And that's pretty much the way it was all through Africa. We did an amphitheater in South Africa in Cape Town on a Sunday afternoon. We had 10,000 people show up. We were a pretty big deal everywhere we went, and all the newspapers, of course, interviewed us and things like that. We even cut a long-playing album in Eastern Africa and stuff like that. And oddly enough, at the time, there were actual rock and roll stars touring Africa. Of course, they were sticking to the really big cities like Johannesburg, things like that. But in any case, I think we were 238,000 people that we entertained, they estimated.
Wow.
And I got the Navy commendation for it. I don't think you know anybody else that has a Navy commendation for singing rock and roll in Africa.
I probably never will know anybody else either. That's amazing. You know, your ship basically sailed from Norfolk, Virginia to the western part of Africa. You kind of really went around the Cape. You went all around sub-Saharan Africa all the way back up till you got to the Seychelles on the other side and just played rock and roll at every stop, at every port.
And we went to Aden at the time. Now it's Aden, Yemen.
Yemen, yes, absolutely.
And we went to places like Dahomey, which was, you know, and
no longer exists.
No longer exists.
Right.
We actually dedicated the airport at Lomé Togo, the rock and roll band. It's crazy. But we did a gig there. We were with the Admiral, and the Admiral always loved, believe it or not, the bunny hop. So we'd have to play for this Admiral who had the Congressional Medal of Honor and a presidential unit citation from the Second World War. And let me tell you something. When that guy got dressed up in his dress whites with that Congressional Medal of Honor, with that medallion and the sky blue thick ribbon with the white stars, I mean, he was something to behold, I tell you.
You know the important VIP guy had just shown up, right?
Absolutely. He was the spirit of America. I mean, all of its glory and all of its bravery. But anyway, he liked to do the bunny hop. And of course, as a joke, because we got to know him fairly well, as a joke, we'd start like in a little cafe or whatever it was at wherever we were, and we'd start playing and we'd bunny hop, and he'd bunny hop everybody out into the street, pick up people and all, and then we'd stop and take a break. So everybody would be meandering back in and so forth and so on, and he would get the joke and say, you know, okay, I got it. Let's not do that again. But anyway, we were on into the night. So we were past midnight one night entertaining it because he just kept us there and we kept, you know, having fun. So we went back to get the boat back to the ship at the pier, and the crane operator left at midnight. So wait a second, we can't get back to the ship. So Admiral Flucky contacted the American Embassy, and we all stayed in the American Embassy that night on the floor of the office, which was the coldest air conditioning I have ever felt in my entire life. And when we got back to the ship, we were on report for reporting late for duty, which immediately he walked in and tore them up and threw them away. So, Flucky. I mean, we were well loved by all of our other sailors for being so, you know, honored. They hated it. But anyway, we were doing like three shows a day most of the places, so we didn't get really the liberty that they got for running around cities and stuff like that. But it was open bar and open kitchen everywhere we went.
Man, I would have loved to have been able to travel to sub-Saharan Africa like in 1960 like that. That must have just been an incredible adventure.
It was a real experience, but it was fun. We were kind of stars everywhere we went. So, it was good. We worked hard because, like I say, we did three shows a day most of the time.
Well, you were literally rock stars.
We were, literally, yeah. They interviewed us. Said newspapers, we were on the front page, et cetera, most of the time. And it was fun. I mean, it was fun. But here again, I tried to get out of it. But I'm, of course, looking back, hindsight and all that, I'm glad I didn't because, you know, I wouldn't have this story to tell you.
Right. Some of the greatest stories. And we're just scratching the surface. But I also want to talk about what we alluded to earlier, which is that you lived in Baltimore with your family, of course, with us, and commuted to New York. That's because your job was in the advertising world. And as the company grew and as your responsibilities grew with the company, you were basically needing to go to New York because you were doing shots with supermodels in the job you were doing. Essentially, for all you guys who have ever seen Mad Men before on TV, that's what my dad did for 40 years. You know, you went to New York doing advertising, although you were on the vendor side of the house. Not right. So much the Madison Avenue side of the house, but you also ended up doing that job also.
I did.
So you basically had jobs in all of those different sides of the advertising world in New York. So talk to these guys a little bit about, first of all, what happened there to allow you this opportunity to work with supermodels, and also how you were able to keep your relationship with mom and be faithful to her with all these beautiful women around all the time. I know you got a great story about supermodels, so go for it.
Well, basically, we were in the advertising business, yes. We were also in the fashion business, which is kind of an unusual combination, really. For instance, in the whole area of both fashion and advertising, because we had the licenses for Halston and Christian Dior, Burberry, actually 12 other brands as well. So we had involvements with New York, London, and Paris, and all of that on that side of things. So we had to do all the photography shoots, some of which we did in England, but most of them were in New York, either in the studio or on locations. And let me tell you something. I didn't know a single person in either the fashion or the advertising side of things that was not a type A. And I'll tell you something. Many of the women were more aggressive than the male counterparts, too. And so with regard to the models, of course, you have to realize I was the client. So we'd have them in for go-sees, it's called, and they bring in their book and all of that. And sometimes the difference between what those women look like in person without makeup, or at least a moderate amount of makeup on, and when you look through their book, you just had to look back at them and say, is this, you know, you don't ever say anything, of course, like that, but it's going on in your mind. Is this the real you? I mean, is this what you look like? And of course, you got to realize that almost every single shoot I ever had involving the models, and even the top models, like we had Andy McDowell and Celia Ward and Joan Severance, Willow Bay. By the way, Willow Bay is married to the president of Disney, so you can imagine how successful she became. They would spend an hour and a half at least in makeup and hair before we could do a shoot. That's amazing to me. And then when they came out and we did the shoot, we'd have to light them, some of them, a certain way. Other times, afterwards, we'd have to do, of course, retouching. You almost always did retouching. That's nothing against any of them or anything like that. But all I'm trying to say is they were basically real, just real people. And they just happened to be attractive, real people, which is the kind of one I hang around with anyway. But, I mean, when you talked with them, because we would ride from Manhattan out to Long Island sometimes, long ride, especially with traffic, you just sit and talk with them and all. And they would tell you about their childhoods and things like that, and you go back and forth and all of that. It was friendly. I mean, basically, what I found out by hanging around with, like, famous people and rich people, and including the models and all, that they have so many superficial acquaintances that basically their only connection with them is the job. And of course, that was true of me too. But I tried to break through with that and try to talk about if they had kids or just getting married or this or that or whatever. And so I found that that made things a lot better. We could work a lot better together and all. I had a situation with a very, very pretty, naturally pretty, woman called Zaki Murphy. And we were doing a shoot, I think it was a Schenley building in New York, and we were in the elevator. And all of a sudden, she just put her hand on her chest and she was having trouble breathing. So we got her water, took her someplace where she could lie down, so forth and so on. And it took about an hour for her to get better. It was no problem. Never, you know, said anything about it. We just kept going and so forth. Zaki Murphy worked for me for a minimum rate for the rest of the time that we booked her. I mean, that's just the human aspect to it. And that's what I think counts with almost anybody. I don't care how famous they are. I don't care how rich they are. I mean, I've met and dealt with billionaires, actually, and royalty. It all boils down to person and personality. And if you match personality-wise, or if you can, humor helps a lot. But I mean, you know, and that's what counts. They all love their kids. They all want kids. Or they all one day, you know, want to be married. Or they love their husband, whatever it is. Even if they're having problems. They're not going to come out, and you're not going to try to delve into their problems, of course. But, I mean, you want to be, you know, sympathetic and empathetic. So, but, I mean, that's what it really boils down to. And it's really some of the key to that business and breaking through all of that type A and competitiveness where you can just break it down and everybody can relax.
Now, Dad, one of the things I remember you mentioning to me that I've actually talked about in my writings is how you worked with these incredibly beautiful women, and oftentimes they were the most insecure women with the self-esteem problems also behind closed doors.
Well, that's true. Basically, what it is, I think, is that they intimidate men, and at least the men that, you know, they would like to have some kind of conversation or some kind of a, you know, a back and forth with. Basically, the men don't come up to them. They're famous models and things like that. And if they recognize them, if not, if they just happen to be one of the naturally gorgeous, then, you know, they just don't come up to them. So these women almost never had a date. So, you know, that kind of stuff. But I'll tell you something about at least the models that I worked with, which were some of the top. Everybody thinks they never eat anything. Let me tell you something. When you lay out, at least we laid out a luncheon feast, because you always ate well on shoots. When we laid out one, man, they would elbow their way in and they would be eating up a storm. Because they wouldn't eat in the evening, probably. They just eat that one huge meal on you, which is fine because, you know, part of the deal. But, I mean, I never saw one eat two grapes and then go sit down with a glass of water. Never saw that.
Right. You also said you worked with some other people who were rather prominent. You worked with Roy Halston, of course, who's legendary in New York War. And you had some stories about him talking to Liz Taylor while you were in his office. And he had this gorgeous office in New York with, like, the spires of the cathedral behind him and everything. What was that like? Was that just surreal?
Well, in the beginning, we actually signed the agreement when he was on, I think it was Madison Avenue, uptown, and he was only on the second floor. So we kind of got to meet him when he still had a reputation, because he had done the Jackie Kennedy hat and all that. But in any case, we got in there fairly early. The key was his manager, who we were very friendly with because that was the money end of the business. So he was aware of the money end of the business and whether we were making any, how much we were making, whether it was growing, all of that kind of stuff. And so we were starting to make an awful lot of money for him. The point is, then he moved to the Olympic Tower. If you think of the Trump Tower, the Olympic Tower is its equivalent a little bit earlier. And he was on, I think, the 20th floor. And he had technically two floors because he had 20-foot ceilings. He had it all completely mirrored on one side and all wall-to-floor glass on the other side, which looked out over Fifth Avenue. And right behind his desk, if you were talking to him, you saw the spires of St. Patrick's Cathedral. So, I mean, it was a big-time deal. And when he had his fashion shows, he had them right in that office.
That's amazing. That's a heck of an office. If you can hold a big-time fashion show in the office, I think you're doing pretty well.
That's right.
Now, more significantly, even at least in my mind, when you guys took over the Burberry's of London product line, the tailored clothing division for Burberry's of London, you actually started going to London a lot. And indeed had shoots in the north of England. And your photographer was none other than Patrick Litchfield, who was part of the royal family. Next thing I know, you're taking mom with you and you're hanging out with the royal family in England. And they're actually enjoying your company and having mom sit next to this royal guy. And it seemed like you guys had a knack for getting along with really rich, really powerful, even royal people. I remember you guys got invited to the Forbes yacht and to the Forbes's parties, and everybody just loved you guys and gave you positions of honor. What was it like socializing with those folks and doing business with them? And how did you gain such favor with them?
Well, here again, it's a personal basis. I mean, Patrick Litchfield, who was the Queen's first cousin, he had a great sense of humor. And we would always be joking and things like that. In fact, I'm making fun of Burberry's in some cases. But he and I just would have big fun together all the time. I love cars. He loved cars. He would have a new car every couple months. And he hated English cars, which was funny. Finally broke down and got a Jaguar. And as the first week, the air conditioning all spilled all over his shoes. And so he took it back to them and got a Mercedes again. You know, that kind of thing. So we had a lot of fun with that. And he always topped me. No matter what I came up with, he would always top my stories. No matter what I had that I thought was so unique, like crossing the line at 00, like I mentioned with the Emerald Shellback, told him the story and said, I crossed on the Britannia.
Right, exactly. Well, how in the world are you going to top a member of the royal family at anything?
Yeah, so then I would pull out something else. And he would beat me on something else, too. And then we'd laugh about it like crazy. But we were having dinner, and we were sitting on chairs. There was, 10 chairs there. And one of the guys, Chalky, who was Charles White, call him Chalky, of course. And so Chalky, I think it was leaning back on the chair, you know, like guys do. And he went, Chippendale, Chalky. And he went, oh, sorry. So he put the chairs down. Guess what? Your mom and her girlfriend were doing on that very day. They were in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian Institution, and they were looking at the Treasure House exhibit. And from Patrick Litchfield, there were two Chippendale chairs there.
The same one the guy was just reclining on, just casually.
Can you believe that? I mean, you can't make this stuff up, actually.
Now, you mentioned him, of course, being royalty and kind of being a big deal. He was styled as Lord Litchfield, right?
Lord Litchfield. He used to have an L over a crown on his car door in gold.
Now, moving on, you've been a sports fan all your life. You were a heck of a baseball player growing up. And one of my greatest memories as a kid, well, two of them, actually. Let me go throw two of them out there. Both great sports memories that you're directly responsible for. That I remember as a boy is, first of all, taking me to Baltimore Colts games at the old Memorial Stadium back when the NFL was still really a working man's gig and guys were drinking and getting drunk in the stands. And it was just really an exciting time. And I remember going to games where we would beat the Miami Dolphins somehow, somewhere, and people would rush the field and pull down the goalposts. I remember that. And I remember you taking me to those games, and it was just great fun growing up. And of course, the Baltimore Colts moved my senior year of high school, so that was a treasured memory. And of course, you also took me to the World Series.
Right.
Then the American League Championship Series, one game of each, and we heckled Pete Rose. And I remember all those. And, you know, that one in particular is kind of a bucket list item that I don't have to cross off later in life because, you know, you made it possible when I was younger. But being such a sports fan, you were able to somehow combine your career in the men's tailored clothing industry with your passion for sports. And the next thing I know, at this point in your career, you were doing TV commercials with like some of the most legendary sports figures of all time. I mean, you had like John Havlicek, you had Brooks Robinson, you had Gale Sayers, all these guys doing TV commercials with you. How did you connect and relate to those famous athletes? I mean, you got Yogi Berra stories that are amazing, although you said he never did a Yogi Berraism in front of you, which was disappointing. But tell these guys how you were able to pull all that together and some of the memories from that.
Well, actually, here we go back to trust. And we got friendly with Brooks Robinson. He was a Baltimore. He actually was born in Little Rock, Arkansas. But he was a Baltimorean because he played 17 years or so with the Orioles. And, of course, everybody knows all the accolades, et cetera.
Sure.
In fact, he was just honored for a lifetime and for the Gold Glove Award, which I stored for him while he was building his house, by the way. Actually, so we got friendly with him, and Brooks is so revered and trusted throughout all of sports. Of course, he's in the Hall of Fame of baseball. We utilized Brooks's honesty, if you will, almost, and his regard by other players of his caliber to sign up with us. And all he had to tell them was, hey, these are good guys. They'll never, you know, hurt you. And they're honest and, you know, they do right by you and all this kind of stuff. I think we signed 30 guys from Hall of Fames, hockey, and I mean, everything. It was amazing. Football, basketball. Anyway, so Brooks got everybody to sign up. Now, we decided we were going to go into TV, and we're going to advertise on TV, and we're going to do a 60-second commercial. So I had never done any TV other than watch it my whole life. So even though I was in advertising, I'd never really been in that end of it at all, never involved. So the agency had set up a big preliminary meeting, and we were going to go through the schedule for it and how we were going to handle it and all and the script and everything else. So I show up, and here's a whole bunch of people sitting there. They're all involved. They had years and years and years of experience. Haskell Wexler was going to be the cinematographer. Well, Haskell Wexler happened to have two Academy Awards. Anyway, we got the best. And so I walk in. And they start out and they start to tell me how the 60-second spot is going to go. So I immediately said, hold it. I don't like that. They had set it up so that there was a 10-year-old boy who makes an error at third base. Brooks comes out of the stands, takes his glove, and shows him how to play that ball. I said, there's no way I'm emasculating a 10-year-old boy. I said, what we're going to do, because Brooks's 1970s World Series was so spectacular that everybody remembers him throwing a guy out. Of course, it was a slow runner, Lee May, but from way beyond third base in the foul territory, all this kind of stuff. I said, we're going to redo that. We're going to show a couple of those. He's going to show the kid, but the kid is going to recognize him in the stands and point him out, and they're going to invite him in to do it. That's what we did. Now, I'm not trying to take credit for any of this, but I'm just saying a lot of times what it really boils down to is just common sense and what's right and what you think yourself about fair play.
The 10-year-old has a great line at the end of that commercial. He goes, didn't you used to be Brooks Robinson?
That's right. We wrote that. I left that in.
Yeah, exactly.
That wasn't mine. That wasn't my line. That was the agency.
Now, Dad, I think these guys have already figured out you're kind of on your best behavior right now, but you're one of the few guys, Emily and I were talking about this actually a few days ago. We were trying to come up with people who are actually legitimately funny on the fly in real life. And there are very few guys who are, and you're one of them. Does that just come naturally for you, Dad, or what are the secrets to that?
It's very difficult to be funny on the spot. I mean, most comedians can't do it. They're in groups or something like that said, hey, be funny. It's a hard thing to do. I think humor is easier than comedy. It's easier to get a chuckle than it is a laugh. I call an audible smile. That's what I'm really trying to achieve. And I think the way to do that is to look for the humor in everything. There is something humorous about everything, even the most mundane things or whatever. And I think that's what brings, you know, out the humor, is if you just allow it to happen plays on words and all of those kinds of things. And I just love humor, and I respond to it. And I think that's part of it as well.
Now, for years, I was in awe of that, and I made it a point over the course of my adult life to get that skill for myself. And, you know, my wife and others would say I've probably gotten there. To me, it's just twisting up whatever it is you see and spinning it a different way. It's the theater of the unexpected, and a lot of irony just makes everything funny.
It does. It does.
Now, Dad, to close off here, I want to give you what I think is probably the golden question of this entire podcast. What are your thoughts on what it means to be a real man? Because I think you've done that all your life. And I think it would be incredibly valuable for all of us to hear your answer.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, philosophical. I would say you have to celebrate natural femininity with natural masculinity.
Well, that sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Well, we're built for manhood. And we're generally bigger and stronger for a reason. Testosterone and estrogen have separate roles. I mean, we're made to please a woman, not be like one. So you got to man up. I mean, whether it becomes protection or providing or whatever it is, it should be a natural role that you take on. And you should appreciate femininity, and femininity should appreciate your masculinity.
Now, see, all these guys just heard that first person, and it sounds so much like what I teach. And guys, it's not that Dad's been reading my books. It's that he is the main influence on what I write and what I teach, and for good reason. You and Mom have walked the talk for over 55 years, and it's an honor to have you as my dad, and I love you, Dad. And I just want to thank you for being on, because this has been an incredible show, and I really trust the guys are going to get a lot out of it.
Well, it's been my honor, Scott. I love you, too. And your mother sends her love as well.
Well, of course. And Emily sends her love, too. We can just have a big love fest from here. But unfortunately, the show's sort of over. So, yes, Dad, thanks definitely for being on. If you want to know more about how to ignite femininity with your masculinity, you definitely want to get in on my newsletter. And you can find out how to do that via the annoying pop-up at www.mountaintoppodcast.com. Also want to remind you guys that we set up a brand new coaching program specifically around the Mountaintop Podcast and this whole idea of being a better man in general. Excelling not only with women in your relationships, regardless of what your relationship status is, but also maximizing your potential in your career, being a man who goes on more adventures and has a more fulfilling life. You can find out how to get in on a free 25-minute call with either me or one of my well-qualified coaches. And you can do that either at the main site at mountaintoppodcast.com or by going to mountaintoppodcast.com/coaching. Until I talk to you again for episode number 101, this is Scott McKay from XY Communications. Be good out there.
The Mountaintop Podcast is copyright 2016 by XY Communications. All rights reserved worldwide. Be sure to visit www.mountaintoppodcast.com for show notes. And while you're there, sign up for the X and Y Communications newsletter. This is Ed Roy Odom speaking for the Mountaintop Podcast.